Wisconsin I is in La Crosse at the 2015 Republican State Convention. We have the luck of, thank you, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, for giving us a few minutes here. Thank you, sir.
Well, Steve, appreciate your interest.
Well, it kind of got more interesting yesterday, didn't it?
Yeah, when, a little bit, I suppose.
Democrat Russ Feingold said he'd like to challenge you again in 2016. Let me ask it this way. When you were elected in 2010, you had not held any elected office. As you go to voters next year, what are you going to list as the major achievements in your first term, sir?
Well, I mean, first, I think we need to talk about the backgrounds, because that's still going to be awful important.
Great.
Obviously, before I ran for Senate, I'd spent more than 30 years in the private sector, in manufacturing, producing plastic products that we actually exported. We didn't export jobs, we created jobs. And that will be contrasted with Senator Feingold, who during that same time period was a career politician. He was basically growing big government. And let's face it, that hasn't worked out too well. So what I've been trying to do, certainly my first four and a half years as United States Senator, is I've been trying to find the areas of agreement. I've actually worked pretty long and hard at trying to find the things that unite us rather than divide us. And you know, one of the things that I think I bring to the table now is Chairman of Homeland Security Government Affairs Committee of the Senate. That's an important position, particularly at this point in time with all the threats that we face.
Yes.
But the way I've approached that committee assignment is the same way as I approach business, is where are the areas of agreement? So. Once we gained the majority, and I knew I'd be chairman, reached out to my ranking member, Tom Carper, a senator from Delaware. Now, we have pretty broad disagreement in terms of how much government we should have, but we have complete agreement that in what government we have, it should be efficient, effective, and be accountable. So first thing I did is said, Tom, let's actually issue a mission statement. A little unusual, I think, for a Senate committee. Maybe somebody else does it. I'm not aware of it. But the mission statement was pretty simple, an area of agreement to enhance the economic and national security of America. So there, you start a new committee assignment with a shared purpose and a mission statement that actually will direct our committee's activity. And so then we started listing priorities. On the Homeland Security side, what can we do to help secure our border? What can we do to improve cybersecurity? What can we do to protect our nation's critical infrastructure, including our electrical grid? What can we do to counter violent extremists? And the fifth priority is maybe a little unusual too, is I've committed myself and our committee to do everything we possibly can to help Secretary Jay Johnson succeed in his mission as Secretary of Homeland Security to keep this nation safe. So, I mean, I think those are pretty major accomplishments. Russ Feingold, 18 years in the Senate, I don't believe he was ever chairman of a major committee like this, particularly at such an important point in time. So that's going to have some big benefits for Wisconsin. For example, when I first found out about the problems in the Toma VA, which was January 12th of this year, mm-hmm. following that publication, I give the news media a lot of credit for highlighting that problem, bringing it to the public's attention. Because I was chairman of the committee, I could decide almost immediately, we're going to hold a hearing on this. And we're not going to hold the hearing in Washington, D.C. We're going to hold the hearing right here in Toma, Wisconsin, so the surviving family members of those veterans that died could provide the kind of powerful testimony that they did in front of the community, in front of hundreds of people in the community of Toma. And that made a big impact on the officials from the VA and the VA Inspector General's office. That's what's going to, I think, from my standpoint, I think that's going to actually lead to real reforms in that facility.
Are you satisfied with the response of the VA to both those issues? Number one, the abuse in Toma. Number two, scheduling, saying they're scheduling appointments in a timely way for veterans? Excuse me, sir.
There have been some improvements made. For example, those individuals were responsible for the overprescription of opiates. They're no longer in that facility. I'm not sure they should still be employed by the VA, and that's one of the reforms that we put forward, is to give the VA greater power to terminate the bad actors. Now, I also have to say, Steve, I think the vast majority of people working in the VA are highly concerned about the finest among us, are trying to provide the best possible care. But in any organization, there are people that just aren't performing, and the VA has to have the capability of terminating those individuals or certainly disciplining them. I think that's probably it in terms of the VA, in terms of what we're trying to do.
Are veterans still waiting too long to get met to see doctors and physicians, sir?
Absolutely. It's a public health care system. It's a bureaucracy. Senator Tom Coburn, I think, issued a really good report that I'd recommend people read. But one of the things he points out is in the VA system, the average caseload for a doctor is 1,200 patients. In the private sector, it's about 2,300. So the only way you're going to start reforming the VA is if the public actually understands the problems associated with it. And, you know, as a result, we can start applying pressure. Now, you asked me earlier, am I satisfied with the VA's response? Definitely not. The Office of the Inspector General and that office is charged with being transparent and being independent. They're not. We actually had to issue a subpoena from my committee. Again, another advantage of being committee chairman, I can make the decision to issue a subpoena to get the information on the case file for the TOMA VA to make sure that 140 reports that the Office of the Inspector General had closed and not providing to the public, those things were made public because of the pressure we applied. And so, no, I'm not satisfied with the response yet, particularly the Office of the Inspector General. I think the VA, I think they're taking it pretty seriously, but again, they're dealing with a public sector healthcare system. That's not going to be particularly effective or efficient.
In your new committee chair, you must get briefings from Secretary Johnson and things like that, but let me ask an overall question. The greatest threat to America in terms of terrorists, in the wake of the Garland shooting, when they say they were homegrown ISIS, do you believe that? If so,
yes.
How widespread is that, sir?
Well, again, we held a hearing in our committee 2 weeks ago. We called it Jihad 2.0. And what we were trying to do is highlight exactly how ISIS was using social media very effectively, in a very sophisticated manner. One of our witnesses has been studying this, and he estimated about a year ago that there were 46,000, maybe as many as 90,000 overt ISIS support accounts on Twitter alone. 46,000 to 90,000 people drawn to this depraved, barbaric ideology. And so the other thing we found out as well is they use the social media to recruit, to inspire. But then once they find those individuals that might be inspired by that, they move them offline into the dark web, into encrypted email accounts. We lose all track of them. And that's the challenge. We've got less than 15,000 FBI field agents, and they've got a lot more responsibility. They're following a whole lot, you know, of other issues rather than just the potential ISIS terrorists that might be inspired here in America. So I really do think that represents the largest threat. One of our witnesses, too, in a rather chilling part of his testimony, said this is just a harbinger of things to come. So I suppose the good news is we're doing a pretty good job of tracing the foreign fighters going back and forth and trying to shut down their ability to go to Syria and come back. But it's the use of the social media. It's the inspiration. So, Steve, the best thing we can do, the number one component of our strategy, is to actually accomplish the goal that President Obama stated, degrade and ultimately defeat ISIS. The sooner the better. And you know, my problem with this president, I don't think he's particularly committed to a very rapid defeat of ISIS.
Do we do that with boots on the ground and in that area of the world, plus fighting it through social media back home? The best way to defeat ISIS, so it's not the threat that your witnesses testified to America, sir?
Well, we do have to do both of it. I mean, we really do have to counteract the social media inspiration. You know, we should be, you know, definitely have a very robust program to counteract that.
Do we have that program, sir?
Not particularly. We've tried. I mean, I'll give the administration credit for at least trying, and I'm not saying this is simple at all, but you know, we invented the internet. We invented social media. You know, we've got incredibly sophisticated communication experts in this country. We just need to employ those and use those in a far more effective manner.
You've heard Senator Kaine argue for a declaration of war on ISIS. Do we need that, sir?
Well, I'm happy to, you know, provide an authorization for the use of military force against ISIS. The problem we have right now in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in which I'm a member of that, is the authorization the president asked for is actually a weaker authorization than the one they're currently using. Now, I'm the guy in committee hearings that pointed out that the connection between the 2001 authorization for use of military force against Al-Qaeda is tenuous at best. Right now, that is the one the administration's using. It actually gives them greater latitude and a greater authorization than what they're asking for. Now, I'm concerned by what the president asked for, a limited time frame, limited in terms of what we would actually, the kind of assets we would employ to accomplish the objective. I think that's one of the reasons that authorization is stalled in the Senate. A lot of us are just kind of shrugging our shoulders going, I mean, what's the point in providing an authorization that's far weaker than the one the president's currently using?
Let's talk about the proposed treaty with Iran over nukes. Your amendment, you wanted 2/3 Senate approval.
Right.
You only got 39 votes. Why didn't you get more?
Well, I think there were a number of senators who wanted to preserve the underlying bill because that was the only advice and consent that the president and Democrats in the Senate were willing to accept. I actually had three amendments I tried proposing. One was deem it a treaty,
yes,
which I believe this thing certainly the rise of the level
treaty
of a treaty
means two-thirds.
Would have required 2/3 affirmative approval in the Senate.
Yes.
Okay, so the Senate defeated that. The next treaty, the next amendment, which never got voted on, I think that's very unfortunate, would have deemed it a congressional executive agreement. There's really three forms of agreements: treaties, congressional executive agreement, and then executive agreement, which is what this president is deeming this.
Yes.
So there's no congressional involvement whatsoever in just an executive agreement. So I was proposing, well, let's at least call it a congressional executive agreement, which would have required an affirmative vote of approval in both houses in Congress. In other words, we should involve the American people through their elected representatives to determine whether this is a good deal or a bad deal for America and for our safety and security. Never even got that vote. The Third Amendment I was trying to at least file, but the Senate parliamentarian ruled it out of order and unconstitutional. I was trying to make a point of what this eventual bill does. I was saying, okay, if you don't agree to the treaty, if you won't agree to 50% approval in both chambers, mm-hmm. let's call it a low threshold of approval congressional executive agreement so it can be approved at 34 votes. And the parliamentarian said, no, that's out of order. That's unconstitutional. You can't approve something with just 34 votes. And that was the point I was trying to make, because that's all this bill does, with a very convoluted process of disapproval that could be vetoed by the president, we would need 67 senators to override that veto, which means only 34 senators in the end will be able to approve what I think is going to be a disastrous deal with Iran.
But there's a bill making its way through Congress that would provide some level of oversight.
That's what
right?
I'm talking about. So
right.
So in the end, I voted for that because that's the only bill that President Obama will sign that Democrats in the Senate will agree to. But what it does, at least, it'll force the administration to show Congress the details of the deal. We'll have 30 days before it can be implemented, before those sanctions can be relaxed.
Right.
And then we'll have an opportunity to vote to disapprove of it. But again, that'll require a 60-vote threshold. And then if President Obama, I would assume he would veto that, we would need to have 67 senators join in overriding that veto to stop the deal. Now, again, that is not advice and consent. That turns the constitutional advice and consent on its head.
Why do you think that the proposed deal with Iran would be, using your term, disaster?
Yeah. Well, if you take a look at UN resolutions dating back to 2006, they imposed sanctions on Iran, and the only way those sanctions were going to be lifted is if Iran suspended or halted its nuclear enrichment program. Mm-hmm. Well, President Obama starts these negotiations, he relaxes some of the sanctions, so you start getting a few billion dollars flowing into Iran, strengthening their economy, strengthening their ability to spread more terror in the world, and he also basically acknowledged their right to enrich uranium. So now all we're quibbling about is, you know, how quickly do the rest of the sanctions get lifted, and how many centrifuges are we going to allow Iran to continue to spin? So this doesn't prevent, contrary to what President Obama is telling the American people, this doesn't prevent Iran from getting a bomb. It puts them on the path to getting a bomb. Maybe not during his administration, but somewhere in the near future. So I think, in a bipartisan fashion, for as many years as this has been an issue, members of both parties have been making the very declarative statement, we cannot allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon, because we all understand the dangers of proliferation and how that endangers world peace, and yet that's exactly what this deal does. In addition, when you take a look at really the dishonesty of this administration describing this deal, they say, well, they're going to ensure it's going to be a peaceful nuclear program. I mean, there's no such thing in Iran. If they want peaceful nuclear power, which they really don't need, they have oil, they can buy the uranium. The only reason they would put up with the sanctions, the isolation, the economic harm by enriching uranium is because they want a weapon. And when President Obama talks about snapback of sanctions, that's impossible. You know, if you lift those sanctions, you'll start having tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of investment from the West going to Iran. It took us 5 or 6 years just for the current sanctions to start taking hold. You will not snap those back. This is a once in certainly our lifetime opportunity to really increase the sanctions, to bring Iran to the negotiating table in good faith to dismantle their uranium enrichment program. That's not what this deal does.
So the best way to stop Iran from getting a bomb would be to ratchet up the
sanctions?
Ratchet
up sanctions, yeah.
Okay.
So that they actually come to the negotiating table and are willing to do what Gaddafi did. Remember, Gaddafi was enriching uranium, but when he saw what the U.S., when we were serious and we showed resolve and we toppled Saddam Hussein, you know, Gaddafi said, I think I'll dismantle my nuclear program. I don't want to also be toppled.
Does your scenario rule out military intervention in Iran?
No, Senator? I don't think we can. I think it would be disastrous for world peace, for our safety and security, to allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. But that's the path that really this deal puts Iran on.
As we talk about terrorism, there's a pending issue. It's got to be resolved by June 1 with the extension of the Patriot Act. Do you agree with the leader of your party in the Senate that there should be a 5-year extension? Or can you see where the House is coming from on the bill it just passed, sir?
Well, we're not talking about the entire Patriot Act. There's about 3 different provisions that we're looking at. And the one that's really controversial has to do with the NSA metadata collection.
Yes.
And again, there's been so much misinformation. You know, the disclosure of Edward Snowden has been so harmful to our national security. But let's describe exactly what that is. What the government is sweeping up are just what the Supreme Court has ruled public records. There's no expectation of privacy here. These are business records. It's just the phone number called from, the phone number called to, the date, and the time and duration of the call. That's it.
Yep.
And nobody is listening to America's phone calls. That's not what's being swept up. And the use of that data has been incredibly limited, less than 200 times. It has stopped terrorist plots.
It has saved lives in America and around the world.
We've been told as many as 10 plots in America, 50 around the world.
Okay.
It has, and by the way, former FBI Director Mueller, former Deputy CIA Director Morrell, both stated that if this program was in place, pretty good chance that we could have stopped or would have known about 9/11. So this is a serious capability. It's not been abused. You know, it's never been, you know, there's been no accusations that any American civil liberties have been abused to this process. I'm certainly not aware of it. And Steve, here's the bottom line. The threats we face are real. Our first line, our best line of defense in terms of keeping America and Americans safe and secure is an effective intelligence gathering capability combined with a robust continuous monitoring and congressional oversight of that capability. Now, I have the advantage, I get to talk to people in the NSA. I get to talk to FISA court judges. These individuals are patriots. They don't want to listen in on Americans' phone calls. They want to keep Americans safe. And the only time that metadata is accessed is when there is a connection to a foreign terrorist that we're just trying to find out, is that foreign terrorist, is he calling anybody in the United States? Very limited use. I do not believe it endangers American civil liberties at all, because we are closely monitoring this. And here's what it should also give Americans comfort. Protecting American civil liberties is not a partisan issue. From the far right to the far left and everywhere in between, we all want to jealously guard American civil liberties. And so I think Americans should be able to rest assured that we're going to be watching that to make sure that doesn't happen.
But the Federal Court of Appeals just disagreed and said that is not a lawful, the collection of metadata. Do I have it right?
Right. Okay. No, so they did not rule it unconstitutional. Previously, Supreme Court ruled that is constitutional. What the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled is that the way that there was not legislation written that authorized it. So there was not proper authorization. You know, again, it could be a legal dispute. What we probably need to do is take a look at that law. Now, unfortunately, again, because of the demagoguery, because of the misinformation, right now the House passed the USA Freedom Act. That's kind of where we're at. That might be as good as we can get, but I guess I'm just warning Americans, I'm warning Wisconsin, that we are reducing our capability and our ability to potentially foil terror plots. And that this is occurring at a time when, just because of the advance of technology, with the dark web and encrypted accounts and how ISIS is using those encrypted accounts, just through technology, our ability to gather that information to keep America safe and secure is also being degraded. So from my standpoint, this is a self-inflicted wound, further degrading our ability to keep this nation safe and secure. I'm highly concerned about it.
The company that you built ships products throughout the world.
Right.
So I want to get your reaction to the Trans-Pacific partner deal that the president is pushing. Is that going to be in the best interest of companies like yours and Wisconsin, which has the second or third highest number of manufacturers in the nation?
Well, we have a lot of manufacturers that export. We have a lot of agriculture products that are exported. We also import products. By the way, people don't understand this. When you import products, that also creates jobs. So I am for free and fair trade. Right now, the only thing we're debating and voting on right now is for trade promotion authority. That basically recognizes you can't have 535 trade negotiators. You really do need to give the president the executive authority, just like in Iran. I mean, I'm happy to have him, you know, negotiate treaties and deals. I just think Congress should have the advice and consent, which is what we would have on any further, you know, any deal itself, you know, in terms of TPA. So I think that the president should have that authority. I think future presidents should, to have that negotiation. But then in the end, we'll take a look at the deal and see whether it really is free and fair trade, and then there'll be up and down votes in Congress.
Okay. So you think the president should have that authority?
Absolutely.
Okay. How do you feel on renewing the Export-Import Bank Charter?
I think we really need to look at some real reforms for that. I've got a relatively open mind. I understand that there's some number of businesses that in Wisconsin that are able to access that Export-Import Bank and can, as a result, export products, but there's been some real corruption in that too. So it looks like right now the House is looking at some reform packages. I'll take a look at that. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to be brought to, you know, in front of the Senate.
You got some criticism for voting for Loretta Lynch as Attorney General. Why did you end up voting for her?
Well, first of all, elections matter. I really do think, you know, the job of a president is a serious responsibility, and by and large, unless I see something really disqualifying in a nominee for a confirmable position, I'll give the president the benefit of the doubt and let him basically staff his administration the way he wants to. Now, with Loretta Lynch, the big problem there, and I certainly didn't agree with President Obama's executive amnesty, but that particular decision on the part of this administration has been transferred to the courts. Now the courts will decide whether that's lawful or constitutional. I certainly did not have any expectation that President Obama would nominate any person for Attorney General that would disagree with his position on that. So had I voted no just based on that, basically I was saying that there's not a person that would be confirmable. So, you know, in the end, I just think you have to give the benefit of the doubt to the president, allow him to fill his cabinet, his administration with his advisors, because elections matter.
Any lessons learned or conclusions you've reached from the debate over police arrests in Baltimore, New York City, Milwaukee, Ferguson, sir? What strikes you about those parts of the criminal justice system?
First of all, I wish political figures in the body politic would first and foremost recognize that the men and women that serve us in public safety are putting their lives at risk all the time, and that the vast majority are just dedicated individuals and doing a great job keeping us safe and secure. And they've got, in many cases, a pretty miserable job, a very risky job. But we also have to recognize that there, you know, some going to be bad actors in any profession. And I think the greatest lesson learned is I think more jurisdictions should do what Wisconsin did, is pull the investigation and the prosecution outside, you know, a local police department and the local administrators, you know, of justice in that area, so that you really have, you know, as much independence as possible when you start taking a look at that as whether or not certain prosecutions are necessary. I'm also generally supportive of body cams for police officers. I think police officers themselves are pretty supportive because they want to be able to defend themselves.
You ran, basically, I remember 2010, one of your perhaps your number one issue was Obamacare. Mm-hmm. How do you look for that debate to be shaped, both in the campaign and over the next 2 years? And if the U.S. Supreme Court wipes out subsidies in states like Wisconsin, what should the response be of Congress, sir?
Well, I'll answer that one first, because I actually have the bill that actually has garnered 31 co-sponsors in the Senate. It's called Preserving Freedom and Choice in Healthcare. You know, basically what it does, it sets us up to have a real debate in the 2016 election about what our healthcare system should look like. And it recognizes reality. So what I'm suggesting is if President Obama gets an adverse decision, if the Supreme Court rules as it should, the way the law is actually written, so those subsidies can't flow through federal exchanges, we're going to have a big mess on our hands, you know, caused by a sloppily written law unlawfully implemented. So
do you want the Supreme Court to rule
absolutely
that way?
Yeah, I want the Supreme Court to rule as the law states. That's okay. What the Supreme Court should
Excuse me.
So what my bill does is it says, okay, listen, if you like your health care plan, you can keep it. Even Obamacare,
I've heard that somewhere on the campaign.
Precisely. I actually mean it, okay? If you like your health care plan, you can keep it, even Obamacare, even your subsidy, through the end of August of 2017.
Okay.
What that does is that sets up the 2016 election as a discussion, the debate, the contest.
A referendum?
Hopefully the mandate on what we should do. So hopefully our Republican presidential candidates would lay out for the American people, this is what our replacement plan would look like, and then that would give us 8 months to repeal and replace Obamacare. Okay. Now, in exchange for cleaning up that mess caused by Obama's unlawful implementation, all I'd ask for is just return a little bit of freedom to the American public. Let's get the IRS out of the business of penalizing, I guess taxing, Americans for not buying a product. So let's eliminate the individual mandate. Let's stop Americans being forced into part-time work. We would eliminate the employer mandate. And let's stop artificially driving up the cost of health care. Let's turn those mandated coverages back over to individuals in the states, give them the freedom to decide what kind of insurance products they want to purchase. So again, that's a pretty limited ask in exchange for kind of cleaning up this mess and setting up the 2016 election as really the referendum on what we ought to do with the healthcare system, which we, you know, 2012, we didn't have that referendum. And it was maybe unrealistic to expect we could because Obamacare hadn't been implemented. People were still relying, unfortunately, on President Obama's repeated assurance, which turned out to be PolitiFact's 2013 lie of the year, if you like your health care plan or your doctor, you can keep it, period. Well, millions of Americans found out that was not true. Millions of Americans are also finding out that the Affordable Care Act is not very affordable. The only people benefiting from Obamacare, almost the only people, are those that are getting the huge taxpayer subsidies. And yeah, they're benefiting, no doubt about it, but there's a whole lot better way of providing that social safety net and making sure that people have affordable quality care.
You also ran on cutting federal spending. So I looked at what you recommended in September of 2011, and I'm just going to ask you about what you've learned about three or four of these potential budget cuts. Cut workforce by 10% by 2015 through attrition, mm-hmm. saving $248
million.
Cut the federal contracting workforce, a billion. Cut the federal contracting workforce, 230, you score that at 233. Yep. Is that a B or a billion?
Those are Bs. And that's not me. That's, I think, CBO scoring those things.
Right. Close federal government computer data centers, $200 billion. And finally, expand public-private partnerships for infrastructure projects, $180 billion. What have you learned about these money-saving changes that they're just not possible to achieve in Congress?
Well, without leadership and without a president who's dedicated to limiting the growth of federal government, you just can't accomplish these things. You know, I hate to break it to people, but there's a reality situation right now, and from my standpoint, the greatest impediment to things like tax reform, to regulatory reform, for doing some of these just common sense things. Again, I wouldn't be firing anybody in the workforce, just let's shrink the federal workforce through attrition. You know, in businesses, it's not unusual for, you know, a company that's maybe had their sales reduced, business managers come down and tell the department, say, you got to cut 10%. And businesses are able to do it. It's not particularly fun, but it's effective. It works. We never do that in the federal government.
Is this your biggest frustration after 4.5 years?
Oh, there are so many frustrations, but no.
What's number one?
You know, the biggest frustration is we do not have a president. We don't have leadership that is, A, willing to acknowledge reality and work in good faith to find the areas of agreement to at least put us on the path. You know, except, you know, I'm coming from a manufacturing background. You know, I'm all for continuous improvement. You know, let's at least start going in the right direction and let's start getting the areas of agreement so we can incrementally improve. So at some point in time, we can make our federal fiscal situation sustainable, but we haven't even begun to address it, barely.
Okay, let's close with two questions on politics. Number one, is it good for your party to have 12, 14, 16, 18 potential candidates for president, sir?
You know, I think actually it is, because what I'm hearing out of all the presidential candidates is they're bringing different ideas to the table. So even if they don't make the cut, even if they don't get the nomination, the good ideas that I'm hearing out of so many of our candidates, I think will be embraced by the others. And I think that Alex would be, a pretty positive impact and influence on our eventual nominee. So no, I think it's actually pretty good. I agree with Reince Priebus that we need to kind of make sure that we have control over the moderators. We want moderators of the debate that aren't trying to destroy our candidates, but are actually trying to elicit what their views are, so that Republican primary voters can really make the choice in terms of who we want to be our standard bearer, who we want to be our nominee.
And when people in Washington ask you about Governor Scott Walker, because they really don't know him, How do you answer, sir?
First of all, he's just a good person. Raised a great family, a person of real integrity, and a person of courage. Somebody who, when he ran for election, said, I'm going to fix this budget problem in Wisconsin, and then he did. And then even when, and Steve, you were here, you saw the viciousness of the process. I mean, the death threats, I mean, just vicious. But then Governor Walker, with also courageous members of our Assembly and State Senate, they stuck by their guns and they actually followed through with it. We enacted those reforms and the world didn't end here in Wisconsin. What happened is we balanced the budget. Our property taxes actually reduced a little bit. We've been able to put a freeze on tuition. A lot of good things have happened in Wisconsin because Scott Walker had the courage to stand by his convictions and not be intimidated by just vicious attacks. So. I don't know, that's a pretty good record for a governor of a state that might be aspiring to higher office.
And then the
just might be aspiring, because no announcement
right,
made.
Right, because he's off to Iowa today, because he just might be aspiring.
Well, Iowa's a beautiful state.
Well, here is my final question. What's at stake in the 2016 election for president? What would America look like if it was a President Hillary Clinton, sir?
We will not start addressing these issues seriously. Again, the greatest impediment right now to the things we need to do to get our economy moving, so that we have robust economic growth, so that business organizations can grow and prosper, and then create the good-paying jobs that we all want. The greatest impediment right now is Barack Obama telling Mitch McConnell, regulatory reform's off the table. The cost of complying with federal regulations, according to studies, is close to $2 trillion. Only 10 economies in the world are bigger than $2 trillion. So President Obama, for tax reform, wants a $1 trillion tax increase as the table stakes to even discuss it. So we just do not have a president, a commander-in-chief, that's willing to face the reality of the situation, understands really what makes an economy grow. Obviously, he doesn't. We've had such meager economic growth under his stewardship. So we need a real leader. America is hungering for leadership. America is hungering for a sense of security. And my final point is I'm just asking Wisconsinites and Americans to really take a look at the reality and understand that when you in such uncertain times, when you're looking for that security, after 6.5 years of President Obama's rule, after decades of these liberal progressive programs that promised all kinds of things and putting our financial future in jeopardy, are you feeling more secure? I mean, have you noticed our national security has been reduced? Our income security is reduced? Our job security? Your retirement security? How about your health care security? All these areas of our lives that the Democrats promise are going to make our lives better and secure have actually been reduced, certainly under President Obama's administration. I would say after we spent $16 trillion on a war on poverty, I wouldn't say poverty's been reduced either. So I really want people to look at the reality of the situation, what hasn't worked, And look forward in terms of recognizing what made this country great. It's individual liberty, our free market system, people aspiring to accomplish things, people being able to earn their own success and have the dignity of work. In order to have that, we need a robust economy, and we need leadership that understands how to produce that economic result.
U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, thanks for talking to Wisconsin I. Have a good convention, sir.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Here you go.